Greetings and apologies for the delay in getting this podcast out. We are at Perek Bet Pasuk Zayin. We spent a good amount of time and energy in the previous shiur discussing Mordechai and the name Mordechai and why there's a three-generation genealogy given of Mordechai's ancestry and the chronology and put all those together into a solution. And we're now going to meet the heroine of our story, who is directly related to Mordechai, not just related genealogically, but she is introduced via Mordechai. So Mordechai was introduced, and now Vahi Omen et Hadassah. Mordechai was raising or had adopted Hadassah. Who is Hadassah? He Esther. This is the first of a number of times in the Megillah where the text is going to explain itself, where it's going to use a particular name of a month, or a name of a thing, or a name of a person, and then redefine it by one that is more familiarly known to the audience. So in this case, it introduces Hadassah. That is Esther. And we all know Esther from the story. And so she, like Mordechai, has a Persian name. Esther is a name that is almost all scholars on the Megillah agree that Esther is associated, and Chazal seemed to say this when they mentioned Esther was called Al-Shum Istahar, the Gemara in Masechet Megillah, and Rashi there seems to point it's the name of a star, that Esther is associated with Astarte, the goddess of fertility throughout the Middle East, Ishtar, Ashtoret, etc., and that was her Persian name. Again, like Mordechai, he has not only a Persian name, but one that is associated with idolatry. But she also has, of course, a proper, beautiful Hebrew name, Hadassah, Myrtle. It's a gorgeous name. By the way, it has become the custom for many people who want to name their child one of these names to give them both of them. So many girls are named Hadassah Esther or Esther Hadassah. Hadassah hi Esther bat dodo. So who is this Esther? She is his cousin, meaning her father and his father were brothers. Or more properly, the way the text presents it is, she is the daughter of his uncle. Ki ein la avaim. Why is he raising her? He's raising her not because her parents have abandoned her. Of course, that we don't see that happening in Tanakh. Not because of any other reason, but rather because she has no parents. V'hana'ara yifat toar v'tovat mareh. Now, this is where the literary device of foreshadowing comes into play. And with the difficulty both of an audio podcast where you don't have the text in front of us, I do, but you may not necessarily be following the text. And second of all, where we are not necessarily doing everything in one shot, I have to recall back to the previous shiur, this is where some of the shortcomings of an audio podcast come in. But in the earlier in Perek Bet, the courtiers said to the king, we should seek out Ne'arot betulot tovot mar'eh. And so we already know that the king's men are out looking, because the king agreed to the plan, are looking for young maidens who are pretty. And now Esther is introduced to us as Na'ara yifat toar betovat mar'eh. So she fits the bill perfectly. She's tovat mar'eh. So we already have a strong sense, just as readers of literature, of what's going to happen. The king's men are looking for Narot Tovot Mareh, and we're now introduced to a girl who is Tovat Mareh, who is beautiful. Now, Uvemota via v'ima l'kacha Mordechai lo levat. When her father and mother died, Mordechai took her adopted her as a daughter. That means several things. Even though they're cousins, it seems fairly obvious that Mordechai is significantly older than she is, because otherwise for him to adopt her as a daughter is a little bit strange if they're roughly the same age. But that's, of course, not at all unusual. What is strange is the Pasuk itself, because the Pasuk presents a fact, he raised Hadassah, a reason, she has no parents, a description of the girl, she is beautiful, and then it seems to double back on itself. It goes back to the cause, her parents died, and then it goes back to the original statement of the Pasuk, which is the fact, which is that he adopted her. It uses synonyms instead of omein, instead of labat, instead of the verb. It describes the relationship by a noun. She became as a daughter. Perhaps it gives a little more information that he adopted her immediately upon the death of her parents and not afterwards. But truth to tell, the last half of the pasuk seems to be superfluous. However, this introduces us to a particular literary style that is extremely common in Tanakh. It is a style which is called chiasmus. And it's called a chiasmus, or in Hebrew we refer to it as a chiasmus, using the image of the Greek letter chi, or chi as some refer to it, which is an X, in which you have a literary style which goes A and then B and then B and then A, or it could be A, B, C, B, A, or it could be A, B, C, C, B, A, or it could even be A, B, C, D, C, B, A, and so on and so forth. Now, a chiastic structure, which is, again, very common, and I'll give a couple quick examples in a minute, a chiastic structure can be within one pasuk, as we have here. It can be within one parasha, or within one story. It can even be within a long series of stories. So, for instance, the entire parasha of Bishalach starts out with a war, ends with a war. After the war, there is a challenge of thirst. Afterwards, there is an issue of hunger. Then there's another challenge of thirst. And then there's another war. So you effectively have war, thirst, hunger, thirst, war. And that is a chiastic structure which uses similar themes at the edges and then common themes, the next one in other words, second and second from last, etc., until finally there is, often as not, some middle point which is unmatched. And you sort of see it built as a pyramid. The point of a chiastic structure, and for, as an example, gave one example there from Parshat Bishalach, another example would be the pasuk praising Ya'el in Shirat Dvorah in Shoftim Perek Hey, pasuk Chaf Dalet. Dvorah, singing the praises of Ya'el, says as follows: Tvorach minashim Ya'el eshet chevra keni minashim ba'oel tvorach. And you take a look. The word tvorach appears at the beginning and at the end. Minashim, Tvorach Minashim, so at the end, Minashim Ba'ol Tvorach, Ya'el Eshet Chevra Keni. So you have, she should be blessed, among all women in the tent. Who, what's her name? Ya'el Eshet Chevra Keni. Now the value of that is it ends up putting Ya'el's name square in the middle. That is a nice thing in Shira, in poetry. However, there's some points in which it really is very instructive to follow the chiasmus. If you take a look at the beginning of the book of Samuel, we meet Elkanah, who is married to two women. Peninnah, who he seems to not favor as much, but she has lots of children. And Hannah, who he loves more, but who does not have any children. And yet, we take a look at the opening, the introduction of the wives, we see something curious. The text states as follows, in Shmuel Aleph, Perak Aleph, Pasuk Bet. Velo shtei nashim, he has two wives. Shema chat chana, v'shema shenit pina. One's name is chana, one is pina. Vahili pina yiladim, ula chana in yiladim. And pina had children, and chana did not have children. So what do you have? You have chana, then pina, then pina, then chana. Which effectively puts pina in the middle. And tells you that within the context of the family, pina is the main wife. Whether or not Elkanah favors her, she's the main wife because she's the one who has children. And that sets the tone for the rest of the story. So often identifying the chiastic structure and identifying the center of it, which is then the centerpiece, as it were, helps us understand the rest of the story. Now let's go back to our pasuk and we'll see why that is helpful and significant here. We are presented with Esther. Esther is raised by Mordechai because she has no parents and she is very beautiful. And when her parents died, Esther and Mordechai adopted her as a daughter. So again, what is sitting squarely in the middle? Hanara yifat toar v'tovat mareh. The girl is beautiful and yifat toar. So she's tovat mareh. She is good looking, as the young men described to the king what they should be seeking. And she's also yifat toar, of a good figure, perhaps. Unclear exactly what the difference between yifat toar and tovat mareh, but they both are describing physical beauty. So we're immediately presented with information that this girl, with all of the things around it about Mordechai raising her, is a beautiful girl. And so we know what's going to happen. Let's keep reading and follow how she ends up being taken to the palace. And so when the king's word and his protocol came out, now this phrase is very tricky. Uvihi kavets, when they were gathered. Who was gathered? Na'arot rabot el Shushan habira. Many young girls were gathered to Shushan, to the fortress. El Yad Hegai. They were gathered to Hegai, the fellows in charge, to the fortress. Vatilakach Esther al Beit HaMelech el Yad Hegai Shomer HaNashim. And this Hegai is going to play a far more important role than is commonly assumed, as we will discover in a couple of moments and over the course of this year and the next year. However, Uvihi Kavets, that word, when they were gathered, does not necessarily mean that a bunch of girls were running to Shushan. And as I pointed out in the last year, it's very likely that if parents heard that the king was looking for a new queen, that they might not necessarily produce their daughters. But they were gathered. They were brought to Hegai, who was already introduced to us in verse 3 in our chapter, as the one who was in charge of the women. So they were brought there. Vatilakach Esther. Esther was taken. Taken means taken by force. El Beit HaMelech. And of course, this story, like many pieces of the Megillah, as I pointed out in the first shiur, evokes for us a much earlier story that we're all familiar with in Tanakh, which is the taking of Sarah to Paro. It's almost the same exact phrasing. And there we know how things play out. In the meantime, Sarah's brother, who really is her husband, gains great benefit. Here we're going to have something that is a little bit different than that, which is that Esther's cousin, who we don't know is a cousin, ultimately is going to benefit from this relationship as well. Although the way it plays out will be very, very different. Of course, the association of the 127 provinces and the 127 years of Sarai is something that Ba'alei Agadah, masters of homiletics have spilled much ink over. In any case, now, we're given some information, but no explanation as to why yet, but critical information. This girl, Hana'ara, Esther, found great favor in his eyes meaning the eyes of Hegai. And Vatisachesa lefanav, she found great grace before him. In other words, he took a shine to her. Now you gotta remember, he is in charge of multitudes. We'll assume now hundreds, if not thousands, of young girls who are coming in to begin the process, as we're gonna find out, a year-long process of preparing themselves to go meet the king. And he takes a shine to Esther. We don't yet know why. Vayivahel et tamrukeha vet manoteha la tetla. And he sped up, he hurried up her tamrukim. Tamrukim are skin treatments. And manoteha, all the portions that she got. Ve'etsheva ne'arot, and the seven girls, haruyot la tetla mibet ha-melech. In other words, she had seven servant girls who it was appropriate for her to get in Beit HaMelech. So she was she got those girls. Vayishaneha v'naroteha l'tov beit hanashim. And he favored her, he discriminated in favor of her. In other words, he changed things in her favor, l'tov beit hanashim. So in other words, Esther is now getting a better deal than the rest of the girls because Hegai likes her. Now in the meantime, lo higida Esther et amma v'molata. This is a very famous piece of the story. Esther did not reveal her nation or her, now, molata here is a little tricky. Normally we translate moledet, and I believe it's a mistranslation, as birthplace. And that's because in modern Hebrew we refer to it that way. We all have great emotional attachment to Eretz HaMoledet, to Eretz Yisrael. And when we translate the opening passage in chapter 12 of Bereishit, Lech lecha mi'aretzcha moledetcha, I think your birthplace. But that's not what it means, because that would make no sense here. For Esther to say, oh, by the way, she's not going to tell the fact that she was born in Shushan. Why not? Moledet here seems to mean family. So she did not reveal her nation nor her family, meaning her relationship with Mordechai. She did not reveal that. Ki Mordechai tziva le'asher lo tagid. So why did she not do that? So we have several options. Option one would be she decided she didn't want to. So option two would be because there was no reason to. Option three was because she was following the dictate of Mordechai. And that's indeed the information here. Now, pointing that out means that there was opportunity for her to notify, and perhaps she was even asked. but she refused to answer, and not because she made her own decision, but rather because Mordechai had told her not to. Now, we have two different issues here. One is the question of why Mordechai insisted that she not reveal her nation. And on that, the Rishonim are divided in two opposite directions. Because it really depends, was Mordechai interested in Esther succeeding in this competition to become queen or not? If you think about it, there really is no, well, perhaps you could argue that there is a downside to being selected queen, is that look what happened to the last queen. And indeed, the queen would be, therefore, would have to publicly be involved in all sorts of things that perhaps would not be to Mordechai's liking for his cousin to be doing. On the other hand, it's not as if all the girls who lose the competition then get to go home. They are consigned to the palace forever in any case. So there really doesn't seem to be much of a downside to becoming queen. So there are those who argue that Mordechai did not want Esther to lose and felt that there was enough anti-Jewish feeling in the palace that if she told people she was Jewish, then she would be disfavored and in some way she would not be selected. There are those who suggest the opposite, that the reason that Esther did not reveal, that Mordechai told her not to reveal her nation, and specifically her family, because her family traced its lineage back to Shaul HaMelech. And the concern was that if she let Ahasuerus know that she came from royal blood, from the tribe of Binyamin, that she would automatically be selected as a more fitting queen because of her royal lineage, and that that would not be good for Esther, and therefore Mordechai suggested or commanded her not to reveal it. In any case, we have those two opposite directions. I have attached a link on the website to a shiur that I wrote a number of years ago on the subject. The interested reader or listener will pursue it on his own. In any case, that is where things stand. The other point is not really a question, but an observation. We notice now that Esther, who is within the confines of the palace and under the strict guard of Haggai and within all of the procedures and protocols of the seven girls helping her and all of the oils, nonetheless, it's her cousin Mordechai on the outside of the palace who is still directing her life. And that loyalty on her part will play out very critically, and there'll be a reciprocity to that loyalty, which will show a shift in their relationship, which we will get to in a number of shiurim when we get to chapter 4. In any case, this passage ends up as follows. Uvechol yom vayom, Mordechai mitalech lifnei chatzar beit hanashim. So every day Mordechai was walking in front of the courtyard where the women were kept. Now this is not such a simple image. Perhaps we imagine people inside a building and the street is right outside and anybody can walk past and perhaps people can peek in the window. That's not at all the case. This is the palace gates. And not just anybody can walk up and certainly be there every day walking back and forth. So how was it that Mordechai was able to do this? It seems quite clear from the entire plot of Megillat Esther that Mordechai was himself a member of the court. That is, of course, in chapter 3, why he can raise Haman's ire for not bowing down to him, because it was only members of the court who were ordered under the king's fiat to bow down to Haman. But in addition, the second half of this pasuk becomes also problematic. Ladat et shlom Esther umaye aseh ba. Why did he walk back and forth every day to know how Esther was doing and what's going to be done with her? Well, how would he know what was being done with Esther on the inside by walking on the outside? The simple explanation to this, without going too far into mental and literary gymnastics, is to posit that Mordechai had some eyes and ears inside the palace, which was not at all uncommon in the Persian court, and that he had someone who was reporting to him via some method how Esther was doing. Now, whether that someone knew that they were related or whether there was some other smokescreen and a way for him to keep that relationship quiet is unclear. But it does seem that Mordechai had eyes and ears inside the palace, a point that will become very critical at the end of chapter 2 and super critical in the middle of chapter 4, to understanding the plot. now we get a description as we move on to the second phase of this scene. The first phase of this scene was Esther being brought into the palace and Mordechai is concerned for her and his command for her. The second phase here is a description of what each one of the girls would go through in preparation for the night with the king, and how they would approach the king, how they would enter the king's chambers. This seems to us to be absolutely without value. Why would we want this in Tanakh? Why would we want to spend our time reading it? We will see why. Because remember, we asked the question, how is that Esther was able to gain the favor of Haggai? Which becomes much more important than we think when we think about all the different girls coming to Ahasuerus and what's going to tip the scales in favor of one over the other. Haggai is the one who's in charge not only of their treatments and not only of which girls are going to attend them, etc., but he's also evidently the one in charge of the schedule of when each girl is going to go visit the king. And so that is a critical thing, because if the girl goes to visit the king on a day when the king is otherwise occupied, or the king has had a bad day or just lost a battle or something, or the king is physically ill, so that's one thing. If on the other hand it's a time when the king is feeling jolly and happy and feeling good and pleased with himself, that will be a different piece. We'll see another variable, which is much more of an objective variable, play out, which Chazal pick up on a little later on in the parak. But now we get this description, and we have to wonder what it's for. And evidently the reason that we're given this description is because only by seeing how all of the other girls would behave in preparation for their night, and then hearing about how Esther would behave, do we start to get a clue as to how Esther was able to gain the favor of Haggai, and therefore get his help in making sure that she had all of the pluses, all of the advantages going into the king, which ultimately led to her being selected. Let's see. Uvahagia tor na'ara v'na'ara lavo el ha-melech ha-shirosh. This is a grand buildup. When it was the turn of each girl to come in to the king, miketz hayot la kedata nashim shnei masar chodesh, when she was finished having, as is the protocol for the women, 12 months, kichen yimelu yimei merukehen, right, because that's how long they needed for the skin treatment. Shisha chodeshim b'shemen hamoret, what was the skin treatment? 6 months in myrrh oil, v'shisha chodeshim b'absamim, and another 6 months in spices, v'tamrukehen nashim. And with all sorts of other treatments. I'm not an expert. I don't know what all these treatments are. But suffice it to say that this was a very intense physical treatment. And with this, the girl would come into the king. With what? A kol asher tomar yinaten la lavoima. Whatever she would say would be given to her to come with her. Meaning, if she wanted a particular kind of dress, a particular kind of perfume, a particular musician to accompany her, a particular kind of food to be brought in, or wine to be brought in, whatever she wanted for her night, for the king, would be brought in. Beit hanashim ad beit hamelech. And she would be brought from the women's area, where she was going through this preparation, all the way until the king's chambers. And then, we'll comment on this in a minute, but let's finish the passage. Ba'erev hi va'ah, she would go in the evening, uvaboker hi shava, and she'd go back in the morning. And it was very clear what would happen. She would go there at the beginning of the evening and come back at the end of the night. El beit hanashim sheni, where would she go? To beit hanashim sheni, not shenit, meaning she didn't go back to the same place, but rather she went to another part of beit hanashim. El yad shashgaz suis hamelech shomer pilagshim. And there's something very sinister about this. She didn't go back to Haggai. She went to shashgaz, who was another eunuch of the king, who was Shomer HaPilagshim. He was the one in charge of the concubines. In other words, once a girl went to the king, she was done. It wasn't like she left. She would go and then be part of the harem of the king. She would not come back to the king unless the king desired her and called her by name. Now, we have to posit that the king did not memorize the names of all these girls, but very likely had some secretary who was there in the chambers with him or at the end of the night, and he would tell him, you know, remember, this is the girl with the brown hair, this is the girl who had the violinist playing The Way We Were, or whatever it might be. And then the scribe would know who that was, and perhaps a week later the king would say, where is that girl who had the violinist? Get her back in. But unless she was called by name, she would not come back. Good. That's our description of what would happen to the regular girls. We'll get to Esther in a minute. But notice it says whatever she said would be brought with her. Now, this may sound a little bit un-PC, but nonetheless, we're looking directly at the Megillah, and we have to read it straight. We are talking here about the most beautiful girls in the kingdom, and girls who are, for the most part, not that mature necessarily, at least emotionally so. They're 12 or 13 years old. Now, we're often quite familiar with what young girls who have been raised to be to believe that they are absolutely beautiful, what their psychological makeup is. And often, they are very self-centered and really believe in some sense that the world revolves around them and not necessarily very respectful of others, especially people that they might perceive to be of some sort of a lower station in life. And I can well imagine many of these girls being there and saying to, hey, guy, I want this kind of dress, and I want this kind of wine, and I want this kind of violinist, and whatever it is that she wanted to go into the king. And I can easily imagine a guy saying, look, I know the king, and the king doesn't like that. And the response being, listen, I'm the princess here, I'm the beautiful, what do you know, you're some sort of low-level eunuch. And now, I don't imagine any of this until I get to what happens with Esther. And suddenly I see it in base relief, Esther against the rest of the girls. Let's see it. Uvagia tor Esther bat Avichayil don Mordechai. This, by the way, is very much built up with Tamei HaMikra. When the turn of Esther bat Avichayil don Mordechai, Avichayil, therefore, was Yair's brother. Asher lakach lo levat, again reminding us that that's Esther who we had adopted. Lavol Amelech lo viksha davar. She requested nothing. Ki im et asher yomar Hegai svi samelech shomer hanashim, except for whatever Hegai directed she should have. And then the rest of the pasuk now is almost inevitable. But tehi Esther noseit chen beinei kol raya. Esther was beautiful in the eyes of anybody who saw her, but not exactly beautiful. That's not the word. She was gracious in the eyes of anybody who saw her. Why? Well, let's step back a second. What is man's greatest desire? Man's greatest desire, this could be a very long shiur, and if we had podcasting comments back and forth, might have a great debate. But I believe that man's greatest desire ultimately is to be meaningful in this world, is to have an impact on the world, to feel like their presence, his presence or her presence, made a difference in other people's lives. Here you have a fellow named Hegai. This fellow is older than these girls. And this is a fellow whose job it is to prepare these girls for the king. He knows the king, he knows what the king likes, he knows the king's tastes. And likely often as not, if perhaps not on a regular basis, these girls are what the current jargon goes, disrespecting him, and saying this is what they want. Of course, which doesn't make him feel very good. And then this one girl comes along and says, hey guy, whatever you say. Whatever you suggest, you're the expert. I don't know anything. I'm just a little girl. You, in the meantime, are the expert. You tell me what to wear. This kind of dress, this kind of hairdo, this kind of perfume, you're the expert. Well, of course he's going to like her because she makes him feel like $1 million. She makes him feel like, hey, I'm somebody of worth. I'm somebody of value. I'm somebody who has what to contribute. And indeed, that is the way it plays out because everybody likes Esther. She makes everybody feel good around her. She makes everybody feel good around her because besides her goodness, she also knows how to talk to people. She knows how to address people in a way that plays to their psychological needs. This is a critical piece of the puzzle of understanding the later development of the plot. And that's why at this point, even though this entire story of how she's selected really seems to be unimportant and almost unworthy of the Tanakh, it's in here because it helps us build up an image and understanding of the psychological makeup and strengths and knowledge and intuition of Esther that later will become a key piece in our salvation. So now, Vatilakach Esther al-Melech Hashirosh al-Beit Machuto, when was she actually taken to the king after she had her year? Bachodesh ha-Siri, Chodesh Tevet, in the 10th month, which is Tevet. We will talk at a later point about the use of the different month names. Bachodesh ha-Siri, Hu Chodesh Tevet, but the 10th month is the month of Tevet. And what's important to note, as Chazal point out, is that Tevet is a very cold month. That's December and January. It's not only a cold month, it's also long nights, which means that, as Chazal say, Laila Kar, Shahgufot Nenim Zemizeh, where bodies enjoy being close to each other. And you can well imagine that Hegai wanted Esther to have the best opportunity, so he selected her for her night to go to the king, a long, cold night, as opposed to some girl that maybe he didn't like very much. He gave her a nice, hot night in July. She comes into the king for a few short hours where they're already sweating and uncomfortable. So there's not a whole lot of interest in being romantically and physically close. So again, this night helps, and Chazal is sensitive to this. So what happens? And by the way, this is in the seventh year of the king. We need to know this for two reasons. Reason one is that now 4 years have passed since Vashti was gone, which means for 4 years, this process in one form or another has been going on of the girls getting prepped and primped and everything else for the king and then coming into the king. It's now been 4 years since that started, and only now is there a new queen. There have been 4 years without a queen. The second thing is that when we get to the main events of the story, which happened in the 12th year, that tells us that Esther has been, and again in contemporary jargon, and in deep sleep. She's been in the palace undercover for 5 years, nobody knowing she's Jewish. She's already been there as queen. So the king loved Esther more than all the women, and he also found favor with her more than all of the other maidens. And he took the crown and he put it on her head and he crowned her again, Tachat Vashti, as we pointed out in the last shiur. The phrase Tachat Vashti, which means in place of Vashti, is a superfluous phrase, not necessary here. But it seems to be here to point out that Vashti's shadow hangs over whoever sits on that throne. And indeed, such is the case. Now, the king then has another party in honor of Esther. Vayasa melech mishtei gadol v'chosar av avadav eit mishtei Esther. He made a very big party, the Esther party. He gave some sort of tax relief to all the states, which I am sure at this point they were very happy to get, because between his parties and all of the work involved in finding a new queen, very likely they were suffering. The tax base was suffering. And then he sent out gifts. What kind of gifts? These are gifts from the party that he sent out. This may be already an allusion, if you will, and we'll get to this when we get to the ninth chapter, of Su'uda, Matanot Levyonim, and Mishloach Manot. And now a very alarming verse that says that when the girls gathered for a second time, when there was a second gathering of the girls, and Mordechai was still sitting at the palace gates, and it's very unclear what's happening here, whether this is a little bit of a flashback to before Esther was crowned, I'm just saying that Mordechai continued to sit there, or it's saying that they continue to bring more girls in, in which case Mordechai's concern may have been raised, as Chazal say, what has happened to Esther? Maybe what he did to Vashti, he's now done to Esther. In any case, Ein Esther Mageret Molata V'Etama Kasher Tziva Aleha Mordechai. So we have a repeat of Pasuk Yod Aleph, that Esther is not, Pasuk Yod, that Esther does not reveal her nation and her family connection, as Mordechai commanded her. And Mamar Mordechai Esther Ostah Kasher Tam Omnaito, and she continued to follow Mordechai's direction, just as when Mordechai was raising her. But what, of course, is very different here is that now she's queen of Persia, which means that the queen, who ultimately in the story is going to be running pieces of the kingdom, or at certain points running things, very critical things in the kingdom, and certainly directing Ahasuerus, is herself being controlled by her cousin, by Mordechai, who is on the outside. Mi'etz Hashem, we will pick up in the next year on Thursday at the end of Perek Bet with the very famous plot of Bigtan Vateresh, some more surprising information about that, and then we will move on to the rise of what's his name in chapter 3.